So, dear brothers and sisters, I'm very glad indeed to be here with you on this Buddha Day festival. It's a good place to be, to celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment. I've been spending the last 10 days in East Anglia, mainly in Norfolk, well, in fact, until today in Norfolk. I've been at Pamaloka Retreat Centre, which is just outside Norwich on the River Yare. Rather lovely country, but very flat. And then yesterday I went with my dear friend from India, Maitreya Nagarjuna, on a little bit of a tour of the movement's past. We also took in some art, and we went to the place where Bhante lived before he moved to Padmaloka, Albemarle, named after the previous owners, who were called Albert and Mary. Original, I suppose. Strangely, it was derelict, which was a bit of a shock. Overgrown, buddleia and elderflower and so forth. Completely overgrown, but rather beautiful. And Maitreya decided he was going to buy it. I don't think he really quite understands that rupees and pounds are not the same value. And then we looked at the place where I was ordained, which was a cottage rented by an order member in Thetford Forest. So that was quite an experience for me. And of course, it's now nothing to do with the Tri Ratna movement, whatever we were then, FWBO. It looks a bit shady. I don't suppose they do make drugs there, but it looks like they could do. quite a strong sense of the past, and of course of Bhante and my connection with Bhante at that time, which is what I've been asked to talk about. But before I get to that, I want to talk about something else that had been coming into my mind while I was up in Norfolk, which allows me to work my way into my theme. So I used to come up to Norfolk quite often when I lived in London, particularly with Marichi. She wasn't Marichi then, I wasn't Subhuti then. And we used to come up, we had some friends who lived in Norfolk, in the sort of area where we were yesterday, Reepham. And they were interesting because the father of the man was a quite important English poet, not so widely known, but to those who know poetry, probably quite well known, George Barker. And we used to occasionally go over to see George and his wife, I think she wasn't his wife then anyway, Elspeth, and also Elizabeth Smart is another quite important literary figure, his mother. But The visits to George were particularly notable to me because we would go over on a Saturday night and George would have loads of young people come and visit him, and then a few poets like, John Heath Stubbs and so on. And basically everybody would get roaring drunk. And George, as he got more drunk, got more and more Dionysian. And more and more inspired, but dangerously inspired. You never knew quite what you were going to get. I was completely out of my depth. Completely out of my depth. I didn't know anything about that literary scene, really. I'm, you know, sort of middle brow, I suppose. A very callow youth, unformed, immature, and sort of conflicted. At the same time, with a very strong sense of direction, unfortunately I didn't know where it was going, and a very powerful drive, although I didn't know what to. A quite bewildered youth, entering the hippie age. And George was just out of my ken, as it were. I hardly had any conversation with him. I must have gone over there 4 or 5 times, Moriji and I used to go over, maybe even more than that. I had 2 encounters with him. The first, I remember I arrived and sat in an armchair, a rather capacious armchair that had clearly seen better service, and swallowed one up. But I was sort of looking for some kind of security, because it was a real cold blast, or hot blast, being in the presence of such a Dionysian figure, ready for the bacchanals of the evening. And George just came in the room, came straight up to me, and looked at me sitting down in the chair, and said, he had a sort of 30s upper class accent, poetry is like Perseus' shield. It enables us to gaze at what would otherwise turn us to stone. And walked off. Clearly, he meant it for me. And it wasn't, you know, something he'd been rehearsing all day, I think. Perseus or so. It wasn't like that at all. It was just somehow or other, some sort of inspiration was struck, and out it all came. That was it. I didn't, you know, encounter him again that time. Another time, I was sort of on the fringes of a little circle standing around him, imbibing a red liquid, and the circle sort of slowly disintegrated, and I found myself alone with George. He was standing in the corner, and I was facing into the corner, so he couldn't sort of easily get round me. I didn't mean it to be like that, but that's how it was. And he looked at me, and he looked me up and down, and he said, "You and I have nothing to say to each other. I like the way you occupy space." And then he walked off. And he was right. He was absolutely right. And he did it beautifully, in a way. It absolutely, you know, forthright, direct, man to man, human to human. And at the same time, he sort of said something that kind of connected me with myself. And that's the sort of fellow he was. A few other times I went there, and he was just completely not in the mood, completely internal. And he just, without saying anything to anybody, he'd just get in the car and drive up to Hocum Beach, you know, that long sandy strand, you know, with, you know, a grey foam-flecked sea fading to silvery mist, with a leaden sky overhead and the wind tearing at your hair, and stride up and down, and I don't know what he did. So sometimes he was like that. But why I want to mention this is because there was something about the encounter that I had with him, even though it was just those 2 sentences from him. Sorry, 3, I mustn't exaggerate. That really touched me very deeply indeed. At the time, I, in a way, wasn't aware of it, but I've never forgotten those situations. I can be there now. Well, I was telling you, I was there in that armchair. I was there in that corner. This man, this poet, a true poet, whatever one might think of his poetry, which I found a little impenetrable, to be frank, he was so vividly alive and so vividly in contact with something beyond the dimension on which we normally function, that he just spoke straight through to me, even though I was too unformed to be able to really do anything with it. But it sort of left a trace in me that I think has... it's not too far-fetched to say, affected the whole of the rest of my life. That happens, doesn't it? You meet people, and they touch you, they affect you. In a way, everybody you've ever met is still in you. They don't go away. They're kind of permanently imbued in your psychic makeup. Well, of course, the effect of them depends on the quality of the energy. If there's somebody like George who was, as I say, sort of touched by the god, Dionysus is exactly the right figure to sort of capture his quality. He certainly wasn't Apollonian. He was very Dionysian. So that quality, that more than human quality, sort of resonates within one. Everybody else, they do touch you, they resonate with in you, but they don't necessarily cut below the surface. And it's very, very rare, I think, in life to meet people who really cut below the surface, who get down to something in you that's far more fundamental, almost elemental, you might say, that sort of shakes you. George, I wasn't able really to be shaken by at that time. I wasn't solid enough to be shaken, if you see what I mean. But I'm extraordinarily fortunate that from a relatively early age, from not long after I met George, I came into contact with a man who has shaped my life, shaped me, and to a in a very broad way. What is interesting about the difference between, say, my encounter with George and my encounter with Bhante, with Sangharakshita, is that George and I had nothing to say to each other. Sangharakshita and I had nothing to say to each other. Frankly, we couldn't really meet. He swam in deeper seas than I could know. I couldn't really meet him at all. It's only really relatively recently that I felt I've met him. Although, you know, his depths are beneath mine, I've been able to meet him at a level that is satisfying, I think, to him as well as to me. But what the difference was that he came to meet me. He came to meet me, and he slowly, slowly, slowly drew me into his depths. But I want still to try to... There's something I haven't quite got out here. It's this, you know, when you talk about the influence that people have on you, you can talk about it in terms of the influence their ideas have had. And Sangharakshita has had that influence upon me. His ideas have influenced me very, very deeply indeed. The foundation of my own intellectual comprehension, such as it is on his teaching, on him, you could say. There's no doubt about that. He's opened my taste. He's opened my appreciation of art and culture as more than merely enjoyment, a delight that carries you to a deeper dimension, a deeper level. I remember, for instance, going to the Musée Cluny in Paris with him, a museum of medieval art, which is a wonderful museum. But we went round and he was sort of commenting a little on this and that, but we went particularly to a collection of ivory plaques, and most of it's quite small. And frankly, I wasn't making anything of it. I was in that sort of museum mood where you're kind of looking dutifully and trying to think, what's that about? And, you know, slowly feeling boredom set in, but being too polite to show it. And we're looking at a case with a small ivory plaque in it. And Bhante just said, look at that curve there. And suddenly... That this small piece, I can't remember what it was of. I think it was a scene of Christ with his disciples, as I remember it. it suddenly came to life, came aesthetically to life, and started to speak to me. And that's the sort of influence that he's had on me. Not that I've had that sort of experience with him very often, but when you're with Bhante, and I was his secretary for 8 years, and have worked pretty closely with him on and off since I was ordained in 1973. If you believe it, that was 40 years ago. It's amazing, isn't it? Seems like just yesterday. And, you know, I've heard so many seminars, I've had so many discussions with him, I've been recommended books to read, I've just picked up books that he's reading, and he sort of educated my taste and opened my eyes to the power of art and culture. I don't always share his taste, I have to say. He has a particular penchant for small China painted birds, which I've never particularly liked. But in other areas, he's pretty good. And some of his colour schemes in various places I've not quite understood. Let's put it like that, politely. So yes, he's sort of shaped my taste to some extent. He's also had a major effect on sort of guiding my career, to put it that way. I mean career in the usual sense, the unfolding of my talent and my capacity. He seems constantly to have believed in me, to my astonishment and surprise, because I wasn't a particularly self-confident young man. But he constantly seemed to sort of affirm me without ever really saying anything. He would just expect me to do something and push me. Well, not push, just sort of open a door and say, well, this needs doing, and I would do it. And then find that I could do it, and that I could do it actually quite well. You know, getting me to give talks and things like that. And I'd slowly find that I'd got something of a capacity to put ideas clearly and to communicate them vividly. Largely formed on him. The first talks I gave were simply his talks, including his jokes. You know, if they're good, why make up your own? And they don't know. They'll laugh and think you're a genius. I tell you, it works. You know, slowly you make them your own and make up your own jokes and so on and find your own way of putting things. So, yes, he's stretched me very, very gently, very persistently, without any appearance of doing so. I don't feel I've ever been... Uh-oh. I don't think I've often been pushed. I think sometimes I've been not pushed, but I've found myself standing on the stage with a spotlight on me, not quite sure how I got there. I'm pretty sure he knew, but I wasn't really quite clear how I got there. Very skillfully getting me to go beyond my own limits again and again and again. You know, finding to my delight that I'd got certain talents and capacities, as we all have. And he seemed to sort of know me, seemed to understand me and understand the direction that my particular character could unfold. So, yes, he's had that sort of effect upon me. Yes, a little bit more about the sort of intellectual effect on it. It's not on me, not just that my ideas are formed by him, but I've had a lot of discussion with him. He's often called me to discuss ideas, issues particularly arising in the world around us, in the Buddhist world around us. And Bhante, as probably all of you are aware who've ever listened to him speak, he's got a sharp eye for confusion. He's got a sort of laser beam attention to confusion. He digs out in mithya drishti, wrong views, that is, views that are not concordant with reality, views that stand in the way of the unfoldment of the human spirit, the human genius. He's had that sort of one of the major marks of his character is this capacity to cut through, the sword of Manjushri. In fact, I took the Manjushri sadhana from him because I wanted that sword in my hand. And so I learnt a lot from that. And I've never found him unkind in conversation, and often quite gentle with me, at least. I've seen him pretty fierce with some. But I've always found that I've left with a few illusions disabused, often rather uncomfortably. So yes, he's had that sort of effect. He's very, very clear on principles. I'm sure that all of you are aware of this. What's so distinctive about the Triratna Buddhist community is it's firmly based on solid principles which are relatable to the Dhamma, but that are when you hear them, you think, yes, of course. When you don't see them laid out for you, you couldn't think of them. But when you hear those principles adumbrated, you immediately feel, well, yes, that's what I thought, if only I'd thought, if you see what I mean. So I've learnt to have a kind of a nose for the principle in situations, from him, in situations, in discussions. I've learnt from him to get to the heart of the matter. I do my best. I'm not him, but I do my best to get to the heart of the matter. I've learnt that from him. This is becoming a little random, but anyway, I'm trying to give you an idea of the sort of particularities of what I've got from him. He's got a wonderful sense of humour, but it's never raucous or cruel, although sometimes it can be very gently mocking, but often with a strong sense of affection in it. I've been mocked by him occasionally. I won't tell you because you'll all take advantage of me later. But yes, a gentle sort of mocking, which is communicates more of affection than of mockery, if you see what I mean. So I could go on. There's so much that I've learnt from my contact with him in sort of specifics and in qualities and so forth. But what I really wanted to try to get across earlier is that all of that is, in a way, almost incidental. And what actually I've got from him is not really something I've got from him. It's really difficult to get at. I'll tell you about my first encounter with Bhante. I'm sure I'll get to this in the end. I used to live in North London. I was at college in Kentish Town, and I lived near Hampstead Heath. And, of course, anybody who lives near Hampstead Heath, you spend a lot of time on the Heath. It's a lovely parkland, sometimes quite wild even. And I just go wandering on the Heath, occasionally with the help of a little chemistry. But often with my own bare consciousness, and you know, go through all my sort of rather late adolescent angst up on the Heath, wandering lonely, not exactly as a cloud, if as a cloud, then a rather dark and confused one. And I remember one day coming back from Hampstead Heath, Parliament Hill Fields, if some of you know it, and just coming from the park out onto the road that runs along the outer edge of the park. And as I came out, I, you know, just as one does, sort of looked along the road, and I saw a figure approaching. And first of all, the figure was pretty unusual. It was wearing a brown cloak, a long brown cloak. Now, even in London in the 1960s, and you saw some pretty odd things there, you didn't see people walking around with long brown cloaks. Not every day, anyway. Okay, maybe you did. And the other thing was, he's an older man, He was in his 40s, I guess. But he had long hair. And as he came closer, I saw he had these enormous mutton chop sideburns. And really quite eccentric, sort of, Victorian gentleman type mutton chop sideburns. Slightly disreputable looking, as if they hadn't been combed for a while and perhaps washed either. Anyway, I didn't all see that all immediately. And then I saw that the cloak was sort of slightly open. He was walking with it held from the inside like that. But I could see an orange robe underneath. All of that just sort of caught my eye. But as the figure came closer, what drew me was something that at the time I had no way of fixing in my consciousness. I had no way of speaking about to myself. But I suppose the quality that I would now call mindfulness. Maybe presence would be the best way of thinking of it. Bante walked like he was really walking. A deep, intense presence as he walked. Very solemn even. God, I can see it now. Most people, they're sort of flickering. Their faces, their consciousness, as it were, the aura around them is sort of flickering and twittering with responses to what's around them and their unsettledness. This is a steady, slow march. I don't mean in the military sense. The Buddha speaks, doesn't he, of mindfulness, the monk who walks mindfully being like a stately royal elephant. If you've seen an elephant walk, as I have from time to time in the streets of Ahmedabad, even in Bombay, amidst all the chaos of Mumbai, you'll see an elephant. And the elephant, they walk with such, such weight, but moral weight, you might almost say, aesthetic weight. Each step is really taken. And the elephant just keeps going. We use the word plod, but that's far too prosaic. It's a stately procession. And this figure was walking like that, with a real dignity and presence, integrity, concentration even. None of this could I have put into words at the time. But it left an indelible impression on me, an impression that I didn't sort of carry very consciously, but that went right deep into me, just as George went deep into me and left me with a sort of a sense of a world beyond this world, which could be inhabited, not just a world of literary figures or that you might read about in a book, but something that I felt in relation to me. This was something altogether deeper, more majestic, more final. And of course, a few months later, I went to learn meditation in the Tri Ratna Centre in London, in Monmouth Street, in the centre of London. Monmouth Street, which apparently from medieval times was a place where the alchemists had their workshops and where you could buy all sorts of magical potions and so forth. Well, it still goes on. I bought my magical potions there. I went because Marichi, with whom I was at that time living, heard an interview with Bante on, believe it or not, Women's Hour. Yeah, and Bante was explaining what he was doing. It's an interview with Anne Bancroft, who some of you may know of. And she was asking him about his work and so on and so forth. She was quite closely connected with Bante in the early stages, and her daughter became an order member. She's since left the order. But Anne, after the interview, apparently said to Bante, I think they got talking about the phenomenon of the times, and the phenomena of the times, and particularly the hippie phenomenon and the drugs and all the rest of it. And so she asked him, well, what would you do if a hippie came into your shop? Because the centre was above a shop. It's a very strange shop. It didn't seem to sell anything. Sounds like something out of Hermann Hesse, doesn't it? Bante said, well, of course, I'd invite them downstairs and teach them to meditate. So I thought, well, this is the man for me. He's not got anything moralistic to say about drugs and all the rest of it. In fact, I discovered later that he'd done his own share of exploration. He wanted to understand us and what we were into. So Marichi told me about this, Lin as she was. So I went along, and weird place. This little shop, which, as I say, didn't seem to really sell anything. It was run by an order member who was an expert in Japanese lacquer work, and I think it was his sort of showcase, his shop window. At the back of it, there was a spiral staircase, a very tight spiral staircase, down to what presumably were the stock rooms. And I remember on the ceiling of the staircase, there were two footprints, you know, Buddha's footprints style of thing. I thought, that's weird. Despite LSD and so forth and so on, I still thought it was a bit weird. I was pretty nervous about all that. And I went downstairs into the basement, which had two rooms. They're very, very small. I don't know, 10 by 12 or something like that, one room, and the other one just a little bit bigger. the shrine room is quite strange, because the order member whose shop it was a Zen aficionado. So he tried to create a Zen dojo. And in a Zen dojo, you have two platforms, one down either side of the shrine room, and everybody sits on the platforms facing the wall, meditating. Well, there wasn't room for two platforms, so there was only one. In the other side of the staircase was a tiny little room, which was the sort of tea room and meeting place. And I went in, and it was weird. it was crammed. There was nowhere to sit, nowhere mainly to hide, because, you know, in that sort of situation, unfamiliar situation, you want quickly to find somewhere where you can kind of park your consciousness and feel that you're not noticed, you know, a bit like the ostrich hiding its head in the sand. Anyway, there was Bante sitting across the room. I didn't immediately connect him with this figure I'd seen before. A completely different aspect. He showed a different manifestation. He was in his robes, which were, for some reason, the word worn with a difference came into my mind, maybe because I've just watched Hamlet. But he, I don't know how, they didn't look like a proper monk's robes. They looked more like a Roman toga. And he had a thick woolen orange jumper on, a roll neck jumper, and this long hair and these mutton chop sideburns. And I noticed his fingers were covered in rings. It was really strange, and of course really exciting. This is more like it. At the same time terrifying, and he just looked across at me, and he just looked at me completely uncompromising sort of look, which I quickly hid from. So I fascinated, a bit horrified, and again, the sort of same feelings I get with George, that I don't operate in the same world as him. I couldn't, you know, it's like a god and a human. You can't really sort of interact. He's just more man there than I was. And I wasn't big enough or stable enough or mature enough really to even know how to meet. It's all very instant stuff, which I'm only unpacking later, as it were. Anyway, we went into the shrine room, meditated. I had instant dhyana. you know, another 40 years and I'm still struggling. You know the way it is. The first time you get a hit. And then afterwards, questions and answers. It might not have been this first time, but anyway, a first or second time I went, in questions and answers. And he was sitting on one side of the room on the platform, just a little low platform on one side of the room, other people beside him. And I was sitting, as it happens, just facing him on the floor across from him. Seemed so at ease, so relaxed. And this strange sort of energy to him, really powerful energy. Very calm, but at the same time, kind of fierce, if that's the right term for it. And dangerous, something wild about him. Yes, something Dionysian. Although at the same time, something Apollonian as well. A kind of brightness and elevation, a sensitivity, refinement. At the same time, a sense he was dangerous, like a wild animal, like a tiger or a lion. I've been dreaming of tigers and lions recently. He's sitting across the room and questions and answers. And he was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. He seemed so at ease, just whatever the question was, he could take it and make something of it in so clear. Not as if he was talking about some religion that you had to learn about. He was just talking about life and sort of having examples from, you know, Buddhist kind of doctrinal theory. But I never felt I was being sort of indoctrinated or given anything. Suddenly just talking about life from his own experience, drawing on a vocabulary that was very rich and very deep and completely absorbed, never foreign to him. And I don't remember what the references were. Yeah, he mentioned William Blake. I remember that. And I was quite taken with Blake, at least the idea of Blake. Like most things at that time, I was taken with the idea of them. I really knew nothing of them. He clearly was completely at home with Western culture. And this had been a big issue for me as I'd sort of begun to explore sort of non-European religion, non-Christian religion. I'd found myself more and more drawn to the East, and I wasn't that able to clearly distinguish between Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism. They're all a bit of a mélange for me. I'd sort of come to the conclusion that I was going to have to go to the East and, become a sadhu or a bhikkhu or I don't know what. I didn't really know what. And I thought that's what I was going to have to do because that's where I could get the real thing. It wouldn't be available here. But I didn't want to do that, partly because I was scared. Not that confident in a way, but partly also because I felt so Western. I felt so much a child of my own culture. I didn't want to leave Bach behind. I didn't want to leave Shakespeare behind. I didn't want to leave the English poets, the Jane Austen, you know, just to take at random inspirations at that time. I didn't want to leave Western philosophy behind. I just finished a BA in philosophy. And here was a man who was completely at home in it all. And at the same time, obviously deeply versed in the wisdom of the East. And so sort of freely, agilely calling up references from here and there, but so communicative. I was just fascinated. Hard to explain. Just fascinated. I don't think I could have said, just by the quality of his energy, the particular quality of his energy, which, again, sort of, if I speak now, there's something of George about it, but it was so much deeper, so much rounder. And, of course, he was reaching. He wasn't unable to find anything to talk to me about. He'd got a medium of exchange with me, which he deliberately created, deliberately sought out. I'm sure George did manage to communicate with some. I'm not trying to disparage him. I think he's a great figure. If anybody is interested, there's a book which is based on him, a novel called The Chemical Wedding by, oh, what's his name? Clark? Ah, forgotten. Anybody know it?
Lindsay Clark.
It's all about George. And when I read it, I didn't know it was before I read it. As soon as I read it, this is George. Anyway, I've a great admiration for him and feel he did give me something, even in sort of his very gracious acknowledgement that he couldn't give me anything. But Bante was there, reaching to me and opening himself to me in this very, very easy, egoistic way. Sort of, he didn't mind. He was here. If we wanted, he was here. And I remember I just got kind of caught. I just gazing at him, just fascinated, watching the way he moved, sort of watching the way his mind moved as he spoke, because, you know, I'm beginning to sort of tune in to the sort of flow of his energy. Completely mesmerised, I suppose, quite almost samadhi-like. And he caught my eye. And just looked at me across the room, just 10 feet apart. He just looked at me. I looked at him. He looked at me. I looked at him. Way past the English comfort level. I was getting pretty freaked, actually, to put it mildly. At the same time, I couldn't break the contact. It seemed something too important was going on. And also, I was damned if I was going to be the one that blinked first. I have to admit, a little bit of youthful, competitiveness. Anyway, Bante wasn't competitive at all, so he didn't have to look away. And eventually I just broke the gaze. But he was sort of looking at me and saying, okay, here I am, there you are, okay, now what? The way I've sometimes spoken of it was a bit like doing a few rounds with Dharmavira. Dharmavira taught me karate many years ago. And, if you do a little bit of sparring with Dharmavira, he could knock me flat with his little finger. But he's nodding, he agrees. And he would sort of stand there with a kind of teasing, friendly, okay, let's see what you're made of, sort of look on his face. So something of that flavour with Bante. Not just like Dharmavira, not wanting to show me up or hurt me or anything like that, but just wanting to see what came out of me and test me a bit. So there's that feeling with Bante who's saying, here I am, step up. All completely unspoken. I've never mentioned this to him. I don't think I've mentioned it to others apart from once or twice in talking about my encounter with Bante. But it was a very, very important moment. Because what I contacted was something beyond the intellectual agility and sensitivity and subtlety of mind and depth of understanding, something beyond the kind of inspiration and his practical intelligence. He's created a movement that's gone way beyond him. He set it up on principles that are so clear, so firm, that it's sort of, beyond him. It lives beyond him. And he's doing things he couldn't have imagined, he couldn't have set up, and to his delight and pride. So he's a very capable organiser, a very practical man, very sensitive, all of that. But something more than that, which I don't know what the word is for it. I've recently been interested. You heard me talking about Dionysus. I've been sort of playing with this. I've just given a series of talks at Padmaloka, in which I explored the erotic in spiritual life. Don't get me wrong. When I say erotic, I don't mean sexual. I mean the the deep power in life that is in all our desiring, but which is transcended in our aesthetic responses and our moral responses, in our responses of real communication and friendship, and especially in our faith. That power of eros is in life itself, and then it flows, expresses itself in its highest form in the Buddha Dhamma. And what I had in that encounter with Bhante, I would say, was an erotic encounter. Now, we all know about Bhante. We all know about Bhante. I've never had that sort of encounter with him. Believe me. I wasn't his type. No blonde hair. And as he said to me once when I said, it was always a bit of a puzzle to me why he didn't make a pass at me. He said, well, I think you weren't really my type. Which was sort of mortifying at the time. Not that I was at all interested, but at the same time, you know, one wanted the attention of the big man, as it were, at the same time as not wanting it. Anyway, let's not go any further here. But just to make it quite clear, I didn't go there, and that's it. And of course, you know, that's where that came from, but that's another story. Whatever the side effects may have been. But the Bhante's got this sort of erotic power, in the sense of a sort of something that's deeply, deeply alive, and that he's allowing to express itself in a fully vivid way. George had it, that sort of erotic power, but he hadn't got a means of exchanging with me, and it would have blown me away. I thought of that myth of Semele. You remember that Zeus is after a lovely Greek maiden, as always, and she's on the verge of giving way, and Hera comes and has a chat with her, sees an opportunity. So Hera says to Semele, you know, always wanting to get at Hera being Zeus's wife, the queen of the gods, says to Semele, look, before you give way, let him have his wicked way, get him to promise that he will fulfill any wish that you ask him, ex post facto. Semele says, okay, well, and what should I ask for? She said, ask him to appear as his real self. Because actually the form he's coming in is not really him. It's a sort of guise that he's taken on. And you're not really seeing the real him. Well, after he's had his way, then demand to see the real him. So she said, I'll do that. The hero said, one thing, don't tell him what you're going to ask until afterwards. So, you know, things follow their course, as they usually do, as Zeus is concerned. And Semele gets him to promise beforehand that he will fulfill any desire that she expresses. So afterwards, Semele reminds him of his vow. He says, okay, ask away. So she says, appear to me in your real form. He said, no, don't ask that. You don't know what you're asking. Just don't go there. So he said, this is why Hera's got me to do this. Come on, you appear like that. He says, look, I'm warning you again. If you ask me a third time, I have to do it. Back down. It's not good. It's not good for you. So Semele, of course, is even more determined. So she demands, appear to me in your true form. So Zeus disappears and reappears. And he appears as what to her is just a blazing light, fire. And she's burnt to a cinder. And of course, in the ashes of the in the ashes, it found the baby Dionysus. So if you encounter a force that you are not ready for, it can sort of destroy you. I think that's what George was. He couldn't really encounter me. You'd have just blasted me apart. And perhaps he was suggesting to me, without probably even thinking about it, get the mirror of poetry. If you want to stare into my depths, don't look into them. You'll be turned to stone or fire or whatever. So if you want to encounter somebody who embodies an erotic power, I hope you know what I'm talking about. Well, in a way, I hope you don't, and are puzzled enough to reach beyond your normal ways of thinking. If you want to encounter somebody of that sort of a power, a quality of energy, well, be careful. Find a medium of exchange. And Sangharakshita Bhante has offered us that, and he offered that to me. But for a little while, he opened up to me who he really was. And what I've found my connection with him is underlain all the time, or despite all the detail of it, is underlain by a sort of a sense of his energy, this powerful, very subtle, very real, very deep energy, which speaks directly to me, and which, for much of my association with him, I've not been up to. But he's constantly given me the media to relate to him through. So a man like Sangharakshita, in a way we're all like it to some extent. It's not that he's, you know, a god in any literal sense, but he's definitely, in my experience, has a deeper connection with those powerful suprahuman forces, suprapersonal forces, or force, than anybody else I've encountered. And I've met Tibetan gurus and so forth. There's a particular quality to him that I've never encountered anywhere else. I'm not saying anybody else has to have that experience or that it'll be the same for everybody else, but that's the way it's been for me. I'm not trying to make special claims for him. I'm trying to talk about my experience of him. And to begin with, I was rather in awe of him, despite my, you know, sort of adolescent and early teens and 20s adolescent rebellion, as it were. I was a pretty conventional sort of soul, and really, accustomed to look up and wanted to look up. And so I think I tended to defer probably rather more than I should have done to him. I couldn't sort of be myself, so I'd sort of treat him a little bit like a headmaster or the boss or something like that. And he was kind of okay with that. There were people around who were able to relate to him much more personally. I couldn't until relatively recently. I've not been able to do that. I've had a very strong working relationship with him, a very strong Dhamma relationship with him, but not a very strong personal relationship in that way. I've not been at ease with him until relatively recently. He's not been, therefore, in a way, at ease with me. If somebody's not at ease with you, you can't be at ease with them. So, I don't want to exaggerate this. I'm kind of rather riskily telling you things that I don't usually talk about. It's because I got a lovely email from somebody recently, Mary, who'd read something I've written recently and very much appreciated my openness, so that's provoked me to be rather more open. So it's all your fault, wherever you are. But I'd not found it easy to relate to him. First of all, because, I was somewhat in awe of him, even when I was working with him quite closely. I very rarely had personal discussion with him. In fact, I'd say he rather avoided it. You know, I try to talk about my problems, which were legion, and my difficulties and so forth with this and that. I'm not going to tell you those. But he'd sort of rather quickly change the subject. He clearly wasn't going to play therapist with me. There were other people he did help very much with their emotional difficulties and so forth, and get really very close into their kind of psychic life. I take it the way I see it. I don't think it was a plan on his part, but I think his character, his nature, is to contact, is to relate, is to communicate, and he communicates with whatever channels are open. And for me, those sort of more personal channels were not open, just as they weren't with George. I couldn't meet him there, but he found the ways to work with me, and in many ways I've been amongst his closest disciples and his closest working associates. In fact, when I stopped working with him, he said that he felt his right hand had been cut off. He'd lost his right hand. I mean, I stopped being his secretary and took up a job that he got me to do, which I didn't want to do, but I never regretted. So, you know, to begin with, that phase wasn't that easy. But I'd mainly see it in terms of myself and my own problems, interpret in terms of my own, you know, attempt to work through my kind of public school conditioning. And, you know, I'm after all, the first generation that, well, sex was only just invented, you know, while I was coming of age, according to Philip Larkin. Was it 1964? And... well, he said, alas, too late for me. Apparently it wasn't too late for him, but that's another story. You know what I mean? I was from the generation that was brought up with that sort of repressive, leftover remnants of that repressive model. And we kind of broke free of it without actually breaking free of it, so that you young ones could have all the fun. I deeply resent it. No. Don't go there. So I was sort of still quite diffident in that sort of way. I mean, you know, it's character as well. It's the way one's kind of put together. So, yes, I had sort of difficulty being at ease with Bhante. I couldn't help but be in awe of him. And very difficult to find the right channels to express that. In India... People very easily express admiration and devotion. In fact, sometimes far too easily. Whatever. But admiration, respect, devotion is just natural to people in India. And they feel no embarrassment about it, you know, touching feet and so forth, in a very delightful way, although sometimes to the other extreme. And sometimes without any intervention of brain. But we don't have those traditions, and we rebelled against the whole structure of hierarchy. And coming from a public school at an era when, you know, it was still cold showers and six of the best on the bottom over the bath. I won't go into any other details. And yet, sort of breaking out, I neither had the old-fashioned models of respect nor anything in my present culture that could express it. So I was quite awkward in relation to him in many ways, which must have been uncomfortable for him, but he seemed to handle it okay. And he found other ways of expressing that. But as time went on and I got more and more self-confident, I began to have difficulties with him in other ways. I suppose I no longer felt the same sense of deference in relation to him. I still great admiration, that's never gone away, and a great a deep respect for his understanding and his achievement and so on. But I began to feel that I didn't altogether like him, if you see what I mean, and on almost like chemical level. If you see what I mean, his personality chemistry didn't altogether sort with mine. Clearly there were people it did sort with, and there were people I could get on with. We weren't kind of naturally made for each other. And to be honest, there were things that he would do that I thought, oh, come on, you know, what about this or what about that? You know, things he would say, the things he did do, you know, quite unhappy about some of the things that he did, which I'm not going to go into. Some of them, I think, I'm still don't think they were especially successful, to put it mildly. And some I've since seen I didn't understand. But I began to encounter him, I suppose, more as a human being, as another human being. And to see that whatever my admiration and respect for him, whatever I owed to him, there were things about him, first of all, that didn't kind of just click naturally. You know, you meet some people and you just get on, as we say, like a house on fire without any effort. Some people's a bit more awkward, and then you come into some meeting. And some people you never quite match with, even though you like each other and appreciate each other and so on. So there's that level, which is just personality. And then there's a sort of more moral level where you wish people wouldn't behave like that, you wish they wouldn't do that, and so on, which probably we feel with pretty much everybody. But when I'd had such admiration for him and maybe even a bit over elevated him in retrospect, that became more and more complex. And in a way, what I began to find myself doing was reacting to him. And first of all, inside, feeling very bad about it, because I owed him so much, and I admired him so greatly, and he was so significant a figure in what I'd given my life to, this Tri Ratna movement, that very awkward, finding that, you know, you're kind of emotionally out of sorts. And at a certain phase, I really just had to withdraw a bit. It's a long story, and it's part of many other processes I had to go through. I did a long solitary retreat, which was the final resolution. I sort of decided that I had to kind of sort this out once and for all, and decide whether, in a way, I was on my own, or whether, you know, I could kind of find a new relationship to him. I don't know what was going on his side, but I'm pretty sure it was going on for him too, in another way, not, you know, in relation to my relationship to him. But in that solitary retreat, a number of things happened. First of all, I did the prostration practice, and as those of you who've done that practice know, that you've got the Buddha at the centre, and then in the front you've got Bhante with his gurus, and of course much else besides, but sort of focused on the Buddha. And in front of the Buddha is Bhante. So when you're prostrating, you may think you're prostrating to the Buddha, but Bhante's there. And this was quite problematic, but I just get myself to do it because I wanted to sort of resolve this, in a way, decide whether to get him off the tree or find a new way of putting him there. At the same time, I was read through his memoirs from the Rainbow Road through to Moving Against the Stream, and then I've got some other bits and pieces that come much more close. And I had the extraordinary experience as I was reading these memoirs of great happiness, intense happiness. He's sort of communicating something of himself beyond that personal level of difference between us. Between us, it's to do with me, not to do with him, really. So I began to realise I was prostrating. Something very simple clicked in my mind. I'm not going for refuge to Sangharakshita. I'm going for refuge to the Buddha. But Sangharakshita is the way I get to the Buddha. Everything I know about the Buddha, all my living experience of the Buddha, my sense of the Buddha as a human being, as an energy, as this sort of force or power that I've already spoken of, comes from him. When I think of the Buddha, in a way I'm thinking of Bante, and then more. He's my access route to him. Everything just fell into place. I knew that my confidence in the Buddha, absolutely unshakable. I don't know why, I don't know how, but somehow or other I knew that I could not doubt the Buddha. I couldn't doubt the Buddha because I knew of my own experience that what he said was true, and that what he said he'd experienced, he had experienced. That's the way it was. I don't know how to explain that or whatever, but that's the way it was. And I know that's true. So then Bante took his proper place. It's because of him that I've been able to encounter the Buddha and see the Buddha, the truth that the Buddha embodies. So everything came back together. And I was able to engage in some wonderful communication with Bante, which I hope he'll live long enough to continue further, which of course has been reflected in these papers that I've been publishing. I've been publishing papers which are an exposition of Bante's exposition of his key ideas, his key presentation of the Dhamma, emerging from our conversations. And as I've never experienced with him before, it was a partnership. I'm definitely the junior partner, absolutely no question. But it was a partnership. And I was able to contribute myself fully to the exchange and receive from him fully and sort of make something of it, which I could then open up, I hope, for others. So that's been for me a sort of culmination of my whole experience with Bante. He's gradually led me so skillfully, so naturally, to the point where I could really meet him, as I couldn't meet George, as I couldn't meet him to begin with. And not just to meet him, but to meet the Buddha at the deepest level. Of course, the Buddha is way, way beyond that, but I can meet him. Bante's way beyond where I meet him, but I can meet him. And I'm pretty sure that if I met George now, I could meet him. But whether we'd have anything to say to each other, I don't know, but I'm sure we could meet. So that is what really this business of Kalyanamitratara is about. It's about a meeting beyond what you each are on the superficial level. It's got to come through what you are, superficial level, on the ordinary level. Actually, there's a lot more profundity in the ordinary than we like to think. Oh, that's a deep comment. But you meet at this sort of energic level, at this erotic level, at a level of energy to energy, just as I met Bante briefly, little glimpse deep into him when we looked at each other across the room, as all the time he's been opening up to me, holding open to me, not very consciously, it's just what he is. It's not an easy process. And I think this is one of the most problematic areas of spiritual life in all traditions, the relationship between the more experienced and the less experienced. I now experience it to a much lesser degree with people in relation to me. They don't know how to relate to me. And I know that I'm more than them sometimes. Sometimes I have to be careful because I suddenly realize, he's a bit more alive than I am. But so you have to be awake and not rest on your queso or whatever. It's really tricky. You're trying to meet Dhamma to Dhamma energy to energy, this deep reality, this deep truth within humanity, beyond humanity. But you're meeting as human beings. And as human beings, we're funny old creatures, funny in all sorts of different ways. We're very particular, just genetically. We've got a certain makeup. Throw me at any situation, it's always my reason that will start first. It's the first motor that gets going. You know, my dear friends, often it's their hearts that get going first, or whatever. You know what I mean? We're all built differently, and I think that's quite deeply embedded in us. I think this is, to give an interesting reference, I think this comes from Manoniyama, the level of lower psychological conditioning. We're conditioned, so to speak, to be particular. You can't help it. And then we're conditioned by, I'm English, even though my mother's a New Zealander and my father's a Scot. And I thought I was Scottish when I was brought up until I met working class Glaswegians, for whom I was not only the class enemy, but the national enemy. I was brought up thinking I was Scottish. Weird, isn't it? I'm English, and I've got that sort of conditioning that goes with a certain kind of middle-class, white, English conditioning. You can't help it. Sorry, but there it is. You've got all of that. We're all particular. You can't be general. You've got to be something in particular. Poor Bante's got to be something in particular. He couldn't be a sort of general blob that just took the shape that everybody needed whenever he met them, like something in a, Star Wars film or something like that. Is that the right reference? Anyway, he's got to be particular. And he's a very odd man. I always say, if you want to understand Bante, you've got to realise he came from Mars. Please don't take me literally. Take me literally metaphorically. He was born working class, 1920s, South London. South London, for goodness sake. Not even South London, Tooting. Sorry if anybody's come from Tooting, but it's not the sort of place where that sort of spiritual genius emerges, you'd think. But, it finds the places that it can find. And his parents were not particularly cultured, not particularly educated. And he got this really strange background. Then finding he was gay quite early on, which, 1940, 1935, not on. Knew he couldn't speak about it. Very, very unprepossessing background. I wish he'd been a different guru. Handsome, hetero, and all the rest of it. But he was what he was. It's what he was. And he says himself that when he thinks about it, he really wasn't the right person to start this order. It would have been much better if somebody else had started it, who'd got much more of the right sort of, personality and conditioning and manner and style and all the rest of it, and maybe even birthplace. Been to Cambridge University, of course, etc., etc. But he wasn't. That's what he was like. And so as a particular person, I as a particular person come into a particular relationship with him. And somehow, and all of you, in your relationships with each other, with your own teachers, whether they're, particularly deeply imbued with this spiritual erotic, this dhammic erotic or not, you come into relationship with them as you are and as they are. And you've got to kind of work your way through all that. Work your way through that, which is a long process, to what matters most deeply, so that you meet at the level of what matters most deeply. So you are drawn by your connection with your spiritual friends, with your Kalyana Mitras, whether more exalted than you or less, or more or less the same. You're drawn to this level that is beyond the particular, this sort of living flame of the Dhamma that glows in the heart of individuals like Bante Sangharakshita, Urgyen Sangharakshita. Of course, that flame we caught initially from the Buddha. The Buddha had that flame. And Bhante said that he thought we, you know, we tend to think of the Buddha rather like a monk in a sort of silk robe with the patches neatly sewn on. He said he thinks he was really more like a shaman, a wild shaman. God, have I been going on for that length of time? Anyway, I'll finish soon, don't worry. I taught myself off. More like a sort of, you know, primitive shaman or sort of yogi with, you know, a bit wild, a bit ghost-like. Well, that's what people thought when they first met him after his enlightenment. They thought he might be a demon or a ghost or a bhoot. In India, everybody thinks anything strange is a bhoot, a ghost, or a god. That's what he would have been like. He wouldn't have been a sort of neat, tidy, religious figure, as it were. He was this kind of raw embodiment of truth, of reality, a living frame, a flame of truth, of love, of real love, this erotic power that is true love, that reaches to the heart of the other, not to the fantasy, not to the desire for approval or wish to be special or anything like that, but right through to what is most deeply human in us and that is therefore more than human. That's what the Buddha was like. That's what he did. And he woke that flame up in the world in a particularly uncompromising way and formed a container so that that flame could be communicated to thousands and thousands of people, millions of people, brothers and sisters, even to us. That flame could reach us. It wasn't like George. You and I have nothing to say to each other. He found a means of communicating. He found a way of getting that across. And again, please, I'm not trying to disparage George. I feel some sort of debt to him. I don't want to seem to be disparaging him. But yes, it's the Buddha not only caught that flame, but found the means of communicating to each at the level that was appropriate. And that's what Sangharakshita has done for us. Untidily, messily, at times very inconveniently, leaving all sorts of awkward hostages to fortune, which we all know about, but which are really the reflection of untidy attempts to reach, to get through. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful that that flame has been communicated to me to the extent that I'm able to receive it, to the extent that my little candle can keep it alight. I'm deeply, deeply grateful to Bhante, and above all for his patience with me. I've not been a difficult disciple in the obvious sense. I've not been awkward, and in fact, I've served him very well. It's part of my character is to serve. I love serving. That's what I feel in my sort of almost my major nature is to serve. I even like serving at table. I've served him well. But in a way, he must have felt the sort of gap between us and my inability to really open myself up to him in an easy way. But very, very patiently, finding the means that he could work with me, as with others he's worked in different ways, I feel very, very satisfied with at least as far as he's brought me, far as there is still to go. I feel that flame of the Dhamma is at least fairly safely alight in me. I hope no winds too powerful blow. If they do, I'll do my best to keep that flame alive. But I hope that in speaking in this way, very candidly, perhaps with a sort of a devotion that it could be risky. I hope you don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to ask you to see things as I see them. Each of us must approach things in our own way. But I was asked to speak about this. In fact, the phrase that was given to me was warts and all. I'm sorry if there haven't been enough warts, this being the city of Cromwell, or near to the city of Cromwell. You know, I should have brought out a few more warts, and I've got plenty. It's not for me to paint Bante's warts. They're there, but not for me to paint them. But I hope that in sort of speaking fairly candidly and very off the cuff, I've communicated something of what I've got from Bante and of my own deep gratitude to him, and to some extent sort of repaid a debt. And I hope I've also communicated to you something of the awkwardness of this Dhamma life, and the awkwardness of Sangha, and the awkwardness of especially of Kalyanamitrata. Have you not been hurt by people in the Sangha? Of course you have. Have you not at times been betrayed by people who should have been true to you in the Sangha? Have you not found those who you've strongly looked up to have really shown their feet of clay? Has that not happened? Surely it has with everybody, if any time passes. It's going to happen. We're a bunch of human beings made of human clay, and we're made from the clay which happened to be lying around at the time, if you see what I mean. And it's always particular. You can never be made of a sort of general clay that is feeling type for feeling type for thought type. You can be more or less versatile, more or less broad, but you're always particular. And the whole struggle of Sangha, the whole struggle of Kalyanamitrata is trying to know each other as we are, recognize the truth of that human clay, acknowledge it fully, see what you don't like, challenge what you think is wrong, and at the same time reach for what is deeply human, even beyond the human, in each other. And allow this sort of erotic power, this suprapersonal force, that's what I mean by that. Suprapersonal force is too cold, too cool. But eros is nicely charged and nicely vague and nicely dangerous. And that's what that force is that we're trying to invoke and trying to contact. So I hope I've given a flavour of that. And I hope by sort of explaining something of both the extraordinary gift that Bante has given me, and also something of the complexity of that, and I could have gone into that so much more, I've given you